Hello, this is Beth Ludwig from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the September issue of the Ladies' Home Journal. Our first article is called A Sanctuary for the Soul. In one of Bridget Lamont's favorite photos, her son, Jeff, sporting a crown that sits low over his ears and wearing a tuxedo that doesn't quite fit, presides over the 2005 homecoming festivities at Sacred Heart Griffin High School in Springfield, Illinois. The 19-year-old and his queen, radiant in white satin, looks like the quintessential high school homecoming couple. But maternal pride isn't the only reason Bridget cherishes this photo. For her, it's an emblem of her son's courage and stoicism. Beneath the tuxedo, Jeff weighs just 90 pounds, and under the crown, all that's left is just a wisp or two of his flaming red hair. 3 years earlier, doctors had diagnosed alveolar rhabdomyosarcoma, a rare and aggressive cancer that almost exclusively strikes children and adolescents. They gave Jeff only months to live. Yet after his initial treatment, he was in remission for more than 2 years. Then in late 2004, the cancer came back. Still, Jeff is smiling. "If I had to describe him in one word, it would be fearless," said Bridget. Wiry and athletic, Jeff loved the outdoors, nowhere more than in the unspoiled wilderness of Christmas Cove, on the northern tip of Michigan's Lenni Peninsula. From the time he was a child, Jeff's family, which also includes his father, Tom, and his older brother, Mike, now 28, vacationed there, often joined by Jeff's uncle, Jeff later, who co-owned their beach cottage. As Jeff's illness progressed, Christmas Cove provided a tranquil place to recuperate from the ravages of aggressive radiation and chemotherapy, as well as much-needed sanctuary from the constant focus on his illness. Here, where few people knew about his condition, Jeff was able to forget about the doctors and needles and blood counts. Hiding his thin frame and hair loss with loose clothing and a hat, he could simply be himself. By the summer of 2007, Jeff was down to 76 pounds. Between ever more frequent hospitalizations, he insisted on staying active, sometimes using a walker when he went out with friends. His doctors had exhausted their treatment options, and the family recognized that Jeff was dying. "It was always in the back of my mind that when the time came, we needed something to remember him by," says Ladder. That August, on vacation with his wife and son, Ladder was biking near the cottage where he noticed a spray-painted sign reading, 40 acres for sale. Something clicked. The sign had been there forever, but not until that moment did I connect it with Jeff, says Ladder. I believe it's Later, not Ladder. My next thought was a big, what if? What if we could buy that property and deeded it to the Lenni Conservatory as the Jeff Lamont Preserve? The Lamonts have been involved with the nonprofit conservancy since Mike and Jeff were children. Every year they bought small plots of land, sometimes just 2 square feet, to be preserved in the boys' names. Jeff had proudly hung the certificates in his room. Later mentioned his brainstorm to his wife, Betsy, who called the conservatory about the idea. The next morning, after walking the property, the conservancy team was cautiously encouraging. They said they'd have to run it by their board, but their attitude was, "Great idea. Go raise the money and make it happen," says Later. He located the property's owners to check the asking price, $140,000. "We can raise that," Later remembers thinking confidently. But a big obstacle loomed, talking to his sister. "I was afraid Bridget would be upset that we were talking about this before Jeff had even died. We needn't have worried. Bridget was blown away by the idea. It was more than I dreamed of, she says. In fact, she was eager to share the plan with her son, who was by this time so weak he could barely talk. It was tricky to bring up, said Bridget. We just said, Uncle Jeff has a wonderful idea. What do you think about buying that land along our lane? We'll make it a preserve, and it will always stay as it is. And we'll name it after you, so you will always be with us. Too weak to speak, Jeff's gaunt face nevertheless lit up, and he beamed his old smile. He understood, said Bridget. Later, composed a contribution request letter to send out to friends and family members. He had just finished it when Jeff died on September 21st, a month after his 21st birthday. As the funeral was being planned, later called the property owners to let them know they were ready to proceed. Their response flattened him. They were having second thoughts. In a panic, he phoned Tom Nelson, a land protection specialist at the Conservancy. Nelson was unruffled. Be patient, he advised. Conservation projects take time. But later was worried. Could he ask people to contribute, not knowing whether the land was available? Unsure of how to break this news to his sister, he decided to simply forge ahead. He turned his Wilmot, Illinois home into a campaign headquarters and put his own family and the Lamonts to work, folding, stuffing, sealing, addressing, and stamping hundreds of envelopes. Later and Bridget had five other siblings, and everyone pitched in. We had about 200 names ourselves and a tons of friends, so we ended up with a database about 500, Later says. No matter how crazy it got, we were doing something. We were making something, and it was always a high. Bridget and Tom agree. Writing letters and talking to people about the preserve kept us going for all those months after Jeff died, she says. Later kept up with the fundraising momentum, and Tom Nelson continued to pursue the land purchase. The property had been in Sam and Debbie Middleton's family for more than 70 years, and they feared it might be overrun with development. I explained the legal safeguards the Conservancy could put into place to ensure that the property remains just as it was, says Nelson. And he called in a respected local real estate broker who reassured the Middletons that the Conservancy had a great track record. The couple signed the contract shortly thereafter. Once we knew that the land wouldn't be developed, it seemed like the right thing to do, said Debbie Middleton. The memorial fund now totaled $90,000, an amazing sum for a family campaign based purely on a word of mouth, but still far from the amount they needed. At this point, impressed by the family's determination, the Conservancy offered to provide a loan for the balance if the family would commit to raising the remaining funds. Later, and the Lamonts toasted this news with champagne and redoubled their efforts. Support for the project began to snowball. Tom, a lawyer, had a friend on the local bar association who sent out 500 letters to fellow members, neighbors both in Springfield and in Christmas Cove. They offered their own list. A colleague of Bridget's from the Library Association where she worked sent an email blast to its 2,500 members. And a local TV station ran a feature. There are many worthy causes, but Jeff's life seemed to touch a lot of hearts, says Later. The family reached their goal in May of 2008, less than a year after Jeff's death, but the fundraising continues. We want the land to be used, explained Bridget, so we're trying to raise enough to put in hiking and biking trails and to maintain the property. A few days after June 28, 2008, dedication of this site attended about 70 people, the immediate family held its own private rite, an early morning walk through the preserve and the surrounding area to consecrate the ground with Jeff's ashes. So we know that's where he is, says Tom softly, and so we can feel his presence in the wind and the sound of the water. For Bridget, too, the place that holds her son's ashes speaks more of life than death. There couldn't be a finer memorial to Jeff than this land, said Bridget. It keeps us profoundly connected to him. And for the later, the Jeff Lamont Preserve carries a special satisfaction. It's the best thing I've ever done, he says, without a hint of boastfulness. Now, every time we drive by that sign on the road, there's a little nod of recognition. Jeff's spirit is where it belongs. The next article is under the animal section, called Love is Blind. It was an uncomfortably hot Miami night when I woke at 4 a.m. to a noise I had never heard before. It sounded like a cat growling. The only one of my three cats I ever heard growl was Scarlet, and it wasn't her. And it couldn't be Fashti, who was so unassertive that her mews came out as tiny squeaks. That left Homer, the orphan I had adopted as a three-week-old after an eye infection that required the surgical removal of both his eyes. I named him after the Greek poet who had imagined magnificent epics, even though he couldn't see. The mere fact of Homer's growling, he was unusually friendly, always had me scared. I squinted and struggled to see him in the darkness. Faint light streamed through the blinds from the street lights, but Homer, black and eyeless, was invisible. I could feel him close by, though. I sat up and flipped on my bedside lamp. Homer stood in the middle of the bed, puffed up to about three times his normal size. His back was arched, and every hair on his body stood straight up. His tail bristled and stiff as a pipe cleaner. His legs were set wide apart, and his ears were at full attention. He moved his head and ears evenly from one side with the precision of a sonar disc. His front claws were extended farther than I would have thought physically possible. His growl continued, low and unbroken. Not completely aggressive, yet, but with a definite warning. Beyond Homer, standing at the foot of my bed, was a man I had never seen before. I stifled a gasp as every muscle in my body stiffened and tensed. The buried nightmare of every woman living alone, the scenario that has spawned thousands of horror movies, was playing out right here, right now, in my bedroom. My eyes darted around the room, considering each object I saw and its value as a weapon. The intruder looked as startled as I felt, and for a crazy moment this struck me as ridiculous. Surely, among the three of us, he was most prepared for whatever was about to happen. I mean, he who had broken into my apartment. But then I realized he wasn't looking at me. He hadn't taken his eyes off Homer. He had obviously heard Homer growling, but, like me, had been unable to find any visual evidence of his presence. It was taking the intruder a second to figure out why this cat, who gave every indication of being prepared to attack, had been so utterly invisible. There was something weird going on here, something about this cat. Under more benign circumstances, I would have been deeply offended by the look of horror that spread over his face when he realized what it was. Homer's growl rose dramatically in both volume and pitch. Some cats growl and bristle as a way of avoiding a fight, slowly backing up while maintaining an intimidating posture in hope that their adversary will back down first. But not Homer. He wasn't backing up. He was creeping forward toward the intruder. If you had asked me a day earlier, I would have sworn that Homer would never attack anyone. And then, even if for some altogether unimaginable reason he departed from his usual happy-go-lucky nature, the sound of my no would have stopped him instantly. Homer was a daredevil and a mischief-maker, but he never disobeyed me outright. This fact was a cornerstone of our relationship, one of the fundamental qualities, apart from his blindness, that set him apart. Yet in this moment, I knew that if Homer decided to attack this man, I would be unable to stop him. The only question was how clawed up and bloody this burglar, or I, or both of us, would get in the process of trying to subdue him. It had been just seconds since I had switched on the lamp, and my next move was so obvious I couldn't believe I hadn't done it already. I picked up the phone, and I started to dial 911. "Don't do that," the man said, speaking for the first time. I hesitated for the briefest instant, then looked over at Homer. "Be like Homer," a voice in my head urged. "Act tougher than you really are." "Go to hell," I said to the man, and finished dialing. Then everything seemed to happen at once. "There's somebody in my apartment," I screamed into the phone, as Homer finally sprang into action. He might not have realized how very much smaller he was than this man standing over my bed, but he did know how to pinpoint a location based on sound. By speaking, the intruder had let Homer know precisely where he stood. With a loud hiss that bared his fangs, which until this moment I had thought of as teeth, Homer thrust the whole weight of his body forward and brought his right front leg into the air, stretching it out so far that it looked bizarrely as if the bone connected to his leg to his shoulder had come out of socket. His claws extended even further. Glinting like knives in the lamplight, they slashed viciously at the intruder's face, missing by a fraction of an inch, and only because the man, reflectively, snapped his head back. "Okay, ma'am, I'm dispatching officers now," the 911 operator said. "Stay on the phone." I never heard the rest, because at that point, the intruder turned and ran. Homer, his tail still upright, leaped from the bed and raced after him. "Homer!" My shriek was unlike anything that had ever come out of my mouth. It made my throat feel torn and bloody. "Homer, no!" I dropped the phone and sprinted after them. Like competing runners panting toward a finish line, two separate and distinct fears were in my brain. The first was that Homer might actually catch up to the intruder. Who knew what this man would do if he saw Homer's claws coming at him a second time? But I was also terrified that Homer might chase the burglar out of my front door and to the long corridors of my apartment complex, and unable to see his way back home, be lost to me forever. As this picture played in my head, I was shocked to realize how deep-seated my fear was. That Homer's getting lost had always lain in the background of my thoughts, cold and silent, but ready to rear up at a moment's notice. Homer made it out of the front door and was about 6 feet into the hallway before I finally caught him. At the far end of the corridor, I saw the emergency exit door swing close. I scooped Homer up in one hand. The pounding of his heart alarmed me, though my own chest felt full of liquid fire. Homer resisted mightily, flailing his front claws at random and catching the skin inside my forearm, raising angry red welts. It wasn't until I re-entered the apartment that he seemed to come back to himself. "When I say no, I mean no. You're a bad cat, Homer, bad cat." Homer was panting heavily, his rib cage expanding and shrinking in succession. Then he took a deep breath, cocked his head slightly to one side. One of those things about Homer that he had always clutched at my heart was the way he seemed to be trying to understand me when I talked to him. Like right now, as he tilted his face toward the sound of my voice, struggling to make sense of my yelling. On one hand, every instinct in his body told him that he had done the right thing. There had been a threat, and he had defended his territory and chased off the threat. On the other, here was Mommy yelling at him as he had never been yelled at before. Homer didn't creep toward me apologetically the way he usually does when I was angry. He just sat there on his haunches, his tail curled lightly around his front paws like an ancient Egyptian statue. For some reason, it brought to mind a scene from Ernest Hemingway's novel, For Whom the Bell Tolls. A ragged group of peasants have just done battle with the fascist soldiers in the Spanish Civil War. Among the dead is the loyal horse of an elderly farmer who had joined the fight. Kneeling over the body of the fallen horse, the farmer whispers in his ear, Arras mucho caballo, which Hemingway translates as, Thou wert plenty of horse. The line had always struck with me, a single sentence that contained multitudes. My tiny cat looked even smaller than usual, his head still bent to one side as his fur receded quietly back to its normal dimensions. I knelt down and rubbed him behind the ears. He purred softly in response. I'm sorry I yelled at you, Homer, I said. I'm so sorry, little guy. There was a sharp rap at the door, followed by an extremely welcome shout of, Police! I'm okay, I called, picking Homer up again and walking toward the door. Ordinarily, he didn't like to be held, but now he rested quietly in my arms. I buried my face in his neck, suddenly overwhelmed with gratitude that he saved me from who knows what fate. Homer was clearly capable of behavior, courageous, extraordinary, heroic behavior, that I would never have predicted 3 years ago when I adopted him, or even 3 days ago. I've always insisted that Homer was as normal as any other cat, but now he was something else altogether. Eres mucho gato, Homer, I whispered into his ear. Thou art plenty of cat. The next article is from the greenhouse section. It's called Waste Less, Save More. Making your home eco-friendly is easier than you think, and it's a surprisingly effective way to conserve cash. The first thing to do is pay your bills online. Not only are you saving trees, but you're also saving money, more than $50 a year on postage. Plus, you get 5 hours of your life back. That's how much time you spend every year writing checks and stuffing envelopes. Next, wash your clothes in cold water. Unless you're battling tough, oily stains, switching from hot to cold water on laundry day will get the job done, and you'll soak up 90% less power. Another plus, you'll subtract up to $63 from your utility bill. Switch to compact fluorescent light bulbs. Yes, CFLs cost more than a traditional bulb, but don't let that turn you off. They burn 75% less energy, and they last about 10 times longer. Replace bulbs in your house with CFLs, and you'll save $150 on more than a lifetime of bulbs. Shorten your shower time. Taking long, hot showers feels great, but it's murder on your water and heating bills. Simply reducing your showers by 5 minutes saves money and conserves up to 750 gallons of water a month. Turn down the thermostat. When the weather gets chilly, minimize your carbon footprint by throwing a sweater on instead of cranking up the heat. Every degree you lower your thermostat, you can knock 5% off your heating bill. Shut off the tap when you're brushing your teeth. If you let the water running during the morning and nightly brushing, you'll waste up to 8 gallons of water daily. That adds up to 2,920 gallons a year. Switch to cloth napkins. The average American uses 2,000 paper napkins a year. Limit your paper trail and conserve cash by using cloth ones when you eat at home. Break your bottled water habit. We don't need to tell you that drinking bottled water isn't kind to the planet, but you may not realize how harsh it is to your wallet. If you drink a bottle of water a day, you may be shelling out up to $500 on the stuff per year. Sip from a reusable aluminum bottle instead. Run your dishwasher. Hand washing dishes is tedious and time-consuming. You devote 230 hours a year to the chore. The good news? It's more eco-friendlier and much simpler to lose the sponge and run a full load of dishes. If you have an Energy Star dishwasher, most people do, you'll conserve a whopping 5,000 gallons of water and reduce your utility bill by $40 each year. activate your computer snooze control. Simply setting your PC to inner sleep mode after 5 to 20 minutes of inactivity can save you up to $75 of energy per computer annually. Can't figure out how to do it? Visit energystar.gov for instructions. There are some green gadgets that can help you save money. Switch to a low-flow showerhead. Look for one with a flow rate of 1.5 gallons per minute. You'll waste less water and slash your water heating bill. Use a smart power strip. This gadget really is genius. It senses when electronics such as your computer and TV aren't in use and cuts off their power automatically. Remember, these appliances drain energy even when they're turned off. A programmable thermostat. It automatically adjusts your AC or your heat when you're not home, saving money, about $180 a year on electricity. Buy a water heater insulation blanket. Older water heaters lose heat through the tank walls. If yours feels warm when you touch it, it's a sign you need an insulation blanket. In the health news, there's an update about chemo. It usually takes months to know how well chemotherapy is working. Now you may be able to tell much faster. Using painless, non-invasive positron emission tomography, known as PET, PET scans, researchers at UCLA's Johnson Comprehensive Cancer Center were able to determine whether chemo was killing cancer cells 1 week after the first dose. If it's not helping, you can quickly switch to another chemo drug or a different type of treatment, says the lead researcher, Fritz Eber, MD. Ask your oncologist if you might benefit. Now, if you're interested in losing some weight, here are some easy things you can do to cut down your calories. Some of these simple switches will keep you in your skinny drinks. Drink seltzer instead of a second glass of red wine. It will save you 125 calories. Trade in your daily cola, a 12-ounce can, for diet soda. It will save you 140 calories. Skip the topping on a Starbucks vanilla frappuccino and you will save 90 calories. Swap a high-calorie sports drink, 20 ounces, for plain water and it will save you 130 calories. Further in health news, do women need a daily aspirin? Not if you're younger than 55 and haven't had a stroke or a heart attack, says new U.S. guidelines from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. They found that even low-dose 81 milligram aspirins, that's buffered or coated, increases the risk of gastrointestinal bleeding in women. Your risk could quadruple if you're taking another anti-inflammatory drug as well. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of From Soups to Nuts. I have been reading from the September issue of the Ladies' Home Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope that you've enjoyed it. I'm Beth Ludwig, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. So long until next time.